The following presentation was recorded at the Buddhist Society of Victoria, Malvern East, Australia. Please visit our website at bsv.net.au.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami ito parang sakkhajang dhammo sotappo te. Okay, very good. So today I want to discuss something that's probably my favorite topic. It's the topic of anatta or not self. And it seems to also be one of, you could say like the Buddha's favorite topic. It's a topic that he even said that he taught the most. So the teaching of sabbe sankhara anicca, sabbe dhamma anatta, that all fabricated things are impermanent, and all phenomena is non-self. And so we have this teaching of the Buddha that is like a fundamental teaching that he's taught so often, the most often. And so you have, throughout the years, you've had people say, well, what the Buddha is actually saying there is what this is that there's no self at all. There's no self in any kind of experience. But then you have maybe other people that take the interpretation. They say, well, actually, when you look at the early Buddhist texts, you can see that actually that the Buddha in some cases was saying that we should be developing a particular or a certain kind of what I call a skillful self in some kind of ways. And look, so this conversation has been going on for millennia. We're not going to get it sorted out here today at all. But what I thought I'd talk about today is maybe the position that you might not be so familiar with. I'm not saying that I adhere to any of these positions, but I'm just saying that this is a position that some people take. Actually, even a lot of very prominent contemporary Theravada scholars take this position. I don't want to name them because what I'm going to talk about, I don't want to be lumping everybody into this one position, but it is a general through line that a lot of contemporary Theravada scholars actually take. And that is the position that I'm going to call the skillful self position. And what the skillful self position is that some people say that actually when you look at the early Buddhist texts, there is room, while the Buddha unequivocally said that all things are non-self and we're moving towards a not-self or non-self realization, there is room in the early Buddhist texts where the Buddha does talk about developing a positive kind of self, a skillful kind of self. And so I just want to lay out this position today and just see what you think about it. Maybe we can discuss it later. So essentially, to understand what this skillful self position actually might be that some people say is found in the early Buddhist texts, we have to look back and go, what is the Buddha talking about when he's talking about non-self? So usually what we find in the early Buddhist texts is when the Buddha's talking about non-self, what he usually refers it to is what we call the five aggregates of clinging, or the khandhas, that there's some sort of form, there's some sort of feeling, there's perception, there's fabrications, and then there's consciousness. And essentially we identify with that, but these things are beyond our control. We don't have control over them, so therefore they are non-self. The idea here is that this is what the Buddha was talking about, not self in relation to the five aggregates. And people that take on this position, their central premise is that, well, when you look at the early Buddhist texts, the Buddha never actually made any kind of metaphysical claim about the self. He never made any kind of metaphysical claim about not self either. Actually, it was one of the, there was 10 things that the Buddha said that he just wouldn't give an answer to. One of the, you know, a few of these things were the cosmos eternal, was it not eternal? Does the Tathagata exist or not exist after death? And so this aspect of is there a self, is there not a self, it's tied up into some of these questions that the Buddha never answered. The reason the Buddha said he wouldn't answer these things is because all it does is has people get into what he called a thicket of views. So, and it leads to confusion, and it doesn't lead to the ending of suffering. And you could say the strongest premise for those that take on some kind of skillful self-position is when the Buddha was actually asked flat out, is there a self? Is there no self? There was a person called Vajrakota, the wanderer, who actually asked the Buddha this, is there a self? Is there not self? And like the Buddha just stonewalled him, just didn't answer at all. Absolutely just stonewalled him. Vajrakota got off and wandered away. Not sure if you can get away with that these days, but you know, obviously you could in those days. And when Ananda asked the Buddha, well, why didn't you answer Vajrakota about when he asked if there's a self or there's no self? And the Buddha said that if he had answered Vajrakota that there was a self, then the Buddha would have been accused of adhering to something called eternalism, that the soul is eternal and it goes on and on and on. If he had told Vajrakota that there was no self, he would have been accused of nihilism, which is that there is nothing there. When you die, everything just goes away. The third reason, he said, if he had told Vajrakota that there was a self, then this wouldn't be consistent with the teaching that everything arises and passes away. And lastly, that if he had told Vajrakota that there was no self, what this would have done is just confused him even more, and he would have been even more into the midst of confusion. So this is the reasons the Buddha said that he didn't answer the question about is there a self or is there no self. Now, what we have to remember is why the Buddha wouldn't answer these questions is because the Buddha said in many instances is like all that he teaches is dukkha and the end of dukkha, so suffering and the end of suffering. Anything that was outside of that realm, he didn't really want, he wasn't really interested in it at all. And so in this process of going towards the cessation of dukkha, what the Buddha teaches was he said that he taught things for our long-term welfare and happiness. So the idea here is this position, this, as I said, this what I'm calling the skillful self position, is that a lot of people say that, okay, well, because the Buddha didn't take a metaphysical stance on whether there were selves or not selves, and what he talked about was not self in terms of the five aggregates, we can't really say that he confirmed or denied that there was a self. So this is what we've got, that there's just non-self in relation to the five aggregates. And again, as I said, what these people maybe suggest is that there's plenty of places in the early Buddhist texts where the Buddha talks positively about building a certain kind of self, even though unequivocally he said that there's no self, these things are not self, but he said that there's a certain, the argument is that there's a certain kind of self, a skillful self that people can build. So how do we understand these certain kinds of self, skillful selves? How do we understand these certain kinds of skillful not self reflections as well? How do we sort of pass these things together? When what the idea here is that these people say is that you have to go back to the axiomatic principles of what the Buddha was talking about. The axiomatic principles of Buddhism is that there is dukkha and then there's nibbana. You have, and then you go, that you move either towards nibbana or dukkha depending on your karma in some kind of way. If you develop, and karma is some kind of action here. So if you have skillful action, what we call kusala karma, you move closer to nibbana. If you produce akusala karma, unskillful action, then you move further and further into dukkha. So this idea that we have different kinds of selves, skillful selves, we have a perception of non-self, this has to fit into this doctrine of karma. This has to fit into either skillful and unskillful karma. So the idea here is that the perception of either a self or the perception of non-self is a kind of action, is either a skillful action or it's a non-skillful action. So what the idea is that, you know, the question isn't about is there a self or is there not a self. The question isn't is there a real self or is there or is not self. Is this the real fundamental principle of reality? The question isn't that. The question more is, or the reflection is, that what kinds of perceptions of the self are skillful and do they lead me to a kind of long-term welfare and happiness? And what kinds of perception of non-self are skillful and lead to a long-term welfare and happiness? So we can see in this kind of idea, this kind of position, that both kinds of selves, skillful selves and non-self, the perception of both are a kind of action in this way. So if we look at that, we might start to ask ourselves, well, okay, well, what are these kinds of skillful selves that the Buddha might be talking about here? This is one of the things with the early Buddhist texts. You can look, there's a lot there. You can look through it and you can find things that sort of support your position. You can find other things that don't support your position. But there's a few kinds of positions that people talk about when they say that the Buddha actually encouraged a certain kind of self. And one of the biggest places that you find this is in the Dhammapada in a section called the Atavagga. And I've got it here. I'm not gonna butcher it by trying to remember these things. So I'll read them here. It's a little bit easier. The Atavagga is the self. Basically, it means the self chapter. And so we can see here that there's a Dhammapada verse that says, you know, oneself is refuge of oneself. Who else indeed could one's refuge be? By good training of oneself, one gains a refuge that is hard to gain. And the next verse is, by oneself is evil done. By oneself, one becomes defiled. By oneself, evil is not done. By oneself, one becomes purified. Purity and impurity depend on oneself. No one can purify another. And outside the Atavagga, there's the section on the bhikkhus, or there's chapter on the bhikkhus, and there's a you could say like a home run for this kind of team. There's a passage there in the Dhammapada that says, by oneself, one should censure self. By oneself, one should be controlled. He who guards himself, mindful, will live happily. Self is the protector of self. Self is the refuge of self. Atahi atano nato. Therefore, one should restrain oneself, just as a merchant does the noble horse. So you can see that there's an aspect of the self that the Buddha is talking about. The Buddha also talked about this is in the Anguttara Nikaya, that he talked about the self as a governing principle. I won't go into this because this is a bit longer, and basically the gist of it is, and what is the self as a governing principle? Therefore, you know, a monk goes, well, I didn't ordain just for robes, lodging, clothes, medicines. I ordained for Nibbana. So therefore, and I did this because I'm overcome by old age, sickness, and death. So I know that there's a way out of it. So I want to actually get out of it. So, and this is where I'll pick it back up again. Perhaps the entire mass of suffering and stress should be known. Now, if I were to seek the same sort of sensual pleasures that I abandoned in going forth from home into homelessness, or a worse sort, that would not be fitting for me. So he reflects on this. My persistence will be aroused and not lax. My mindfulness established and not confused. My body calm and not aroused. My mind centered and unified. Having made himself this governing principle, he abandons what is unskillful, develops what's skillful, abandons what's blameworthy, develops what's unblameworthy, and looks after himself in a pure way. This is called self as a governing principle. So we can... You know, the idea here is that if we look at some of these passages here, we can see that the Buddha is talking about developing a perception of a self in a skillful way. You know, self is the protector of self. Self is one's own refuge. He's talking about abandoning aspects of the selves in these different kinds of ways. By self is evil done. So we can see that there's some kind of basis for this idea that the Buddha was talking about certain kinds of skillful selves in this way. But the question might start to come up for you, obviously. It's like, well, why would I develop a skillful self when what I'm aiming towards is not self? Why go through all the loopholes? Like, why not just jump straight to that thing? And so the idea is why one would want to do this is because development on the path is a kind of skill. It's building of skillful actions, and skillful actions take time to master. Just like anything that you need to master, you need to take time to actually develop it. Like anything you want to build, you need different tools along the way to actually build something. So say, for example, you wanted to build a house. You start off with a certain kind of tools, a certain kind of materials. As you go along, you put some of those tools down, you put some of those materials don't matter anymore, and you use other kinds of tools and other kinds of materials. So the idea here is that, you know, we have to develop different things along the way. The idea here is that although we're going towards Nibbana, which is Nibbana is the unconditioned, we actually need to develop condition kind of qualities. So the path to the unconditioned is in some way it's conditioned. And so essentially everything in this path is fabricated in some kind of way. So you have a fabricated path that's leading to an unfabricated goal, the unfabricated goal of Nibbana. And so the idea here is that, you know, the fabricated path, you need to develop some kind of fabricated qualities. And by fabricated here, I mean one needs to develop them oneself, one needs to build them, one needs to basically fabricate them, condition them, put in the right causes. We need certain kinds of fabricated qualities to do this. You know, we need to develop right view, we need to develop morality, we need to develop dana, we need to develop jhana, we need to develop all these kinds of things. So it's a fabricated path that leads to an unfabricated goal. Now, a bit of the idea here is, and this is where it actually gets a little bit contentious, and you might be able to start to see some of the, okay, well, I could go this way, I could go the other way in this line of thought, is that the idea here is that what we do is we use some of these things that we're trying to abandon to develop the path. Again, we use tools at a particular point in time. We put them down later when we don't need them anymore, and we use other tools at other periods of time. So the perception of a skillful self is like a tool that we use at one time and we put it down at other times. And at other times, we might pick up the perception of non-self at different times and put it down at other times. Now, again, this is sort of where it gets contentious in some kind of way, because so the idea here is like, well, how do you actually do this? How do you actually go about going, well, should I pick up a perception of a skillful self? Should I put it down? Should I pick up a perception of a skillful non-self? Should I put it down? How do you actually do? And this is where it gets sort of tricky, and you might sort of see why this is where sort of paths diverge on this. And the idea here is something along the lines that people say that the kind of strategy that one would use, or the technique that one would use, is that you develop to develop the abandonment of attachment or craving, you need some kind of craving. To abandon conceit, you need to develop some kind of conceit to actually do that. The premise for this, there's a section in the Samyutta Nikaya, I think, where Ananda is talking to a bhikkhuni, and he's talking to her about the path towards enlightenment, and he actually says this, is like that we have to develop craving to abandon craving, we have to develop conceit to abandon conceit. And so the idea here is something along the lines of that we use the aggregates, that we use the five khandhas in the ways that we can control to develop these fabricated qualities on the path. So we use the aggregates in some way, we use the khandhas in some way to develop dana. So, you know, the Buddha said that, you know, dana is a foundation for liberation. So we actually need this, use the aggregates to develop dana. We need the aggregates to develop morality. You know, if you look at the 10 courses of skillful and unskillful actions that you find of body, speech, and mind, you find this in the Anguttara Nikaya, the Book of the Tens. There's unskillful actions, there's skillful actions that lead you there. You have to use the aggregates to do this. This is something within your control. You have to use the aggregates to develop metta. You have to develop kindness. There's a section in the Udana where the Buddha talks about if one loves oneself, then one, by default, one starts to love all other beings. And probably one of the most important aspects here is that one uses the aggregates to develop the jhanas. One uses the aggregates to develop calm and concentration within the mind. This develops a kind of self-confidence, a kind of clarity that one actually needs. So again, the idea here is that you use the aggregates in this way to build a skillful sense of self in some kind of ways. You build it to develop these skillful kinds of qualities. And these qualities are really things that need, you know, they need chetana, they need intention. You know, you have to have some sort of desire to move towards nibbana. You need to develop these things in this way. You need to have this kind of motivation. You need to take on, again, you have to take on this kind of oneself is one's own refuge. You have to take on responsibility. You have to have motivation for the goal towards the end of it. And so this is why there's this idea that we build this skillful sense of self. We build this skillful self. We build these skillful qualities. And the reason it's said that we build a skillful sense of self, again, they're relying on the early Buddhist texts, is because if we look at this from like a philosophical perspective, what these qualities of a skillful self entail is this is giving us the necessary and sufficient conditions for enlightenment. If you don't have these necessary and sufficient conditions, you won't actually achieve enlightenment. You won't actually achieve the fruits of the path. And so the idea, we need to actually develop these things. We need to develop these requisite conditions. We need to develop these necessary and sufficient conditions so we can get to the path. So as well, once what the position here is that you build a skillful sense of self up to its utmost point. You build a skillful sense of self in this way so you're able to let go of the sense of self. If you don't have these necessary and sufficient requisites, you can't actually let go of the sense of self in this way. So it's about trying to develop these skillful qualities to be able to let go of them. And the idea here is that one develops a skillful self to its ultimate point. And when one has developed it to its ultimate point, one is imbued with jhana, one's morality is good, the dana is good, one's overflowing with loving kindness, then one can actually start to reflect on these skillful qualities one has and actually start to see that within these skillful qualities, there is still dukkha. There is still, you know, so the example here is something like, within the jhanas, within the bliss of the jhanas, these are still impermanent. If they're still impermanent, they still have some kind of dukkha within them. So we've developed these qualities, we've used these tools to get here, but now we actually have to start to put them down and start to use different tools. We have to start to use different tactics. And this is where these people that take on this position say this is where the reflection of non-self, a perception of non-self starts to come in. You start to look at the things that you can't control, the things that are beyond your control, where you now actually use this reflection to break through and start to understand some of these things in a much more clearer manner. Now, you know, what is beyond our control? Well, again, this is where it sort of gets a little bit tricky. The khandhas are beyond our control. Form, feeling, perception, fabrication, and consciousness, these things are beyond our control. These are the reflection again. These are not myself. These are not mine. These are not myself. This is not what I am. This is the reflection that the Buddha talks about all the time. There's a really nice passage, I think it's in the Samyutta Nikaya, where the Buddha talks about, he's talking to a group of monks about the five khandhas, and he says to them, if you look out in the Jetavana grove in the forest here, if you see a person that is taking all the sticks and taking all the leaves and taking all the twigs and logs and putting them all together, and he's setting fire to them, is that person setting fire to you? Is that person setting fire to us? And the monks obviously say no. And so the Buddha says, well, just as the five khandhas, these are not a self. So even though they are burning, you should not attach to them because they're not yourself. And so the idea here is this is where we start to pick up the skillful perception of not self, to start to look at the aggregates in this way and start to see that they're impermanent, that they're suffering, and that they're non-self. And the reason we do this, what the idea here is, that the reflection or the perception of not self, what this does is start to develop right view within a person. The fundamental requisites for what right view is an understanding of the Four Noble Truths. And it's not just knowing, again, it's not just knowing the Four Noble Truths, knowing that there's suffering, that there's a cause of suffering, that there's an end of suffering, that there's a path to the end of suffering. It's not just knowing these things. It's about reflecting on them and bringing them into one's own mind in some kind of way. And this is what the non-self reflection is said to do. And what this is said to do is, it says to provide the kind of impetus to comprehend that there is dukkha, to actually truly accept that there is dukkha, there's dukkha within the five khandhas, to abandon the cause of craving. The non-self reflection abandons the cause of craving. The non-self reflection allows one to cease dukkha, to realize nibbana. And the non-self reflection allows one to develop the path towards nibbana. And so the more one starts to use this non-self perception with these kinds of skillful qualities and everything within the aggregates, and starts to turn it towards everything that's within our existence, we actually start to let go of the aggregates. We start to let go of the khandhas. We start to not identify with them anymore. And this is what actually starts to bring about what we call abandoning of the fetters, abandoning of the different fetters of attachment that we have, this attachment to the khandhas as a self, as a mine. We start to abandon some of these things, so we start to gradually let go of our attachment to the khandhas. And what that does is starts to move one through the levels of enlightenment of what we call a stream enterer, a sotapanna, and even all the way up to what's called a non-returner or an anagami. So we abandon, and especially at the point of where somebody is an anagami, they abandon all attachment to the khandhas at that time. Now, but you know, they're still not finished their work. There's still some, with an anagami, there's still some kind of attachment there. There's an attachment to something. And there's an attachment there to what we call avijja. Now, I've spent a lot of my life trying to figure out a good translation for avijja, and there's no good one-word translation. So I'm going to give you a very clunky translation of what avijja is. I see avijja as this misapprehension of the fundamental nature of reality as it is, a misunderstanding, a misrepresentation of what it actually is. So essentially, there is still a sense of, even in an anagami, even though they've abandoned attachment to the khandhas, there's still a sense of I am there, or I exist, or there is existence in some kind of way. There's a really nice passage. There's a really nice passage called I think his name was Venerable Kamaka, who was an anagami and who talked about, even though he didn't identify with the five khandhas, they asked him, well, what is it? What do you keep saying is an I? And he went through this really nice layout of what, you know, although he doesn't identify identify with the khandhas, you know, there is still a feeling of I am. There still is a feeling of identification with existence, there's still something there because avijja is still there. And so, again, this non-self perception, if we're applying it to everything, we're applying it to all phenomena now, we're not just applying it to the khandhas, we're applying it to absolutely all phenomena. This is the thing that is said to be able to liberate us and give us freedom in this way. So, if we think skillful selves and skillful not self, again, we're looking at this in terms of karma as a terms of kind of action, different techniques that we use at different times to pick up and put down depending on where we are at the practice. You can't use one in the wrong kind of place. If you use it in the wrong kind of place, you end up going in the wrong way. If you overuse one, you go in the wrong way. If you underuse one, you go in the wrong kind of way as well. So these perceptions of a skillful self and the perception of a skillful not self, these are kind of strategies that we might use. So just to wrap all this up and sort of conclude it, because there's I've thrown a lot at you here. So there is this idea that even though the Buddha unequivocally taught not self, that everything, all conditioned phenomena were not self, that because the Buddha didn't make any metaphysical claims about the self, that there is a self, there is not a self, all we can really infer is that the Buddha was talking about not self in relation to the khandhas and not self in relation to other kinds of phenomena. And this is, but there is room within the early Buddhist texts whereby we could say that the Buddha was talking about what we call, again, as I defined it, a skillful self in some ways. This skillful self develops skillful kinds of qualities, and to do this, we have to think of both selves and non-selves in terms of karma, either karma that's a skillful action, a kusala karma that leads to nibbana, or an akusala karma, unskillful action that leads to dukkha. We have to think of both the perception of self and non-self in this kind of way. And so the question is not, is there a true self? Is there a real self? Is not self the underlying reality of existence? But the question is, how do I develop a perception of a self or a perception of non-self that is skillful, that leads me towards my long-term welfare and happiness and leads me to nibbana? And when are those perceptions unskillful? And the idea here is that, you know, we use the khandhas in a skillful way, and some of the things that we can control, we use fabricated khandhas in a way to move us towards an unfabricated goal. We may be attached to some aspects of the path. We attach to right view. We attach to morality. We attach to developing the jhanas in order for us to eventually let them go in the most healthy and useful kind of way. And once we have developed this skillful self that has these skillful qualities, then we actually can start to let it go through this reflection of non-self. And the more we reflect on non-self by having first built this sense of skillful self, we're actually able to let it go in a more healthy and useful and wise kind of way. So this reflection of non-self actually allows us to develop true right view. It allows us to let go of the khandhas and allows us to let go this fundamental avijja. So again, you start to see at that point, you see beyond everything that's conditioned and unconditioned. You see beyond everything that's fabricated and unfabricated. And at that point, when you've actually finally reached that point, then selves and non-selves just don't matter anymore. So with that, that's a massive dump for you. So that's a bad use of words, but that is a lot of information. So with that, we're going to open it up to questions, but I really need to use the bathroom. So you can either sit here silently or you can discuss this yourselves or you can think of a questions. It's up to you, but I really need to go to the bathroom. Okay, how do we all go?
Thank you.
Good ideas?
Thank you, Bhante, for this most deep philosophical discussion. I can enter this discussion from various points.
Yep.
Probably a fairly long comment here.
Yep.
All of us are born.
Can you hear? Yeah.
All of us are born.
Yep.
This conditioned world, because we have avijja,
yep.
The view of self.
Yep.
So all of us operate on the basis of their self. Buddha understood this. Buddha started from that point, the practice, and when he liberated and understood what the self is all about, he became enlightened. Then he came down to tell us how to get there.
Yep.
So all what he has taught us is to practice gradually to the point where you can understand how this self is created.
Yep.
You kept on saying that to developing a skillful self.
Yep.
I disagree with that, because Buddha, when he talked about skillfulness, he was talking to skillful actions. So we will do skillful actions. When you start talking about skillful self, you are polishing your view of self all the time. You are making it more and more enhanced.
Yep.
That is a very tough way to get about.
Yep.
Because eventually you have to let go.
Yep.
From the very first beginning of practice, you have to think this view of self is only an idea. You may not realize it, but you have to start thinking like that.
Yep.
You will only realize when you enter, become a stream enter to a certain level. As you say, the fabricated situation, unfabricated situation.
Yep.
In the fabricated situation, your words, we are all operating on the basis of self.
Yep.
When it becomes unfabricated, enter into unfabricated state, that is stream enter, that is the time that we start thinking that's sakkaditti, that there is the self is the five aggregates of arising. So Buddha's teaching is not about liberating a self. All the practice is all about how this view of self is created. So that is what we are doing. We are practicing all the time to understand how the view of self is created. That is why he explains very deeply the five aggregates of arising is what you call self, which he says it is dukkha, it is it is impermanent, and there's no self. Every point he says, every time, Buddha kept on saying that. So, Buddha's teaching is basically, as you say, I'm here to say what is dukkha and liberating from dukkha. That's what he, as you said, I'm here to teach you suffering and end of suffering. End of suffering, this conditioned world is suffering and impermanent. End of suffering, according to Buddha, comes when you don't claim ownership to this. You don't claim. You claim ownership if there is a self. If you have no self, there is no owner. So if you understand through wisdom, not just in the head, but you're practicing really deep in your heart, that is how you get liberated from suffering. There is no other way. So I would disagree with saying that you have to first develop the skillful self, and then you become to a point where you become unskillful self. I think from the very, very beginning of the practice, you had to think that there is no self. It is only an idea. It's an illusion. Avijja. That's what I say.
For sure. Yeah. And look, I totally agree. As I said, this is just a position that some people take. This is a position that a few contemporary Theravada scholars actually take in some kind of way. I just think it's a sort of a position that's there, and so I guess the and you're right, you know, we do have to start with this kind of idea that, okay, this thing that I think is a self, the khandhas that I think is a self, this is not a self, I'm only identifying with them, they're actually not self. I think this is something that we can do along the way, and we have to start from this. We have to start from this point as well. I think the what some people are worried about in some ways is that sometimes people take the doctrine of no self, and they maybe misunderstand it in some ways, and thinking that, well, if everything's no self, non-self, then, you know, you're not going to, it's like, well, why would I bother? Why would I bother trying to move towards the path? So the idea here is that this is a way for people to still develop the kind of right kind of qualities that they actually need to get to that realization. So the worry is that people take the non-self doctrine and grasp it in the wrong kind of way. So that's why they in some ways talk about skillful selves in this way. You know, they might call it a positive sense of self. I agree. I'm not so keen on the skillful self position myself. So again, it's just a position that's there. So again, this is why, again, there's been millennia of discussion about this, and you know, if we can work it out today, like, cool, like, that's great.
Thank you, Ajahn. We'll just alternate between questions in the room and the online questions, of which there are quite a few, as you might expect. But I'll just start with the first one. I'm not quite sure. It sounds like just a comment or looking for a confirmation. But the question is, the non-self of the three characteristics could be understood like there's a list of skillful actions, the 37 bodhipakya dhammas, that can be mastered, like a musician can master a song. At the point there is nobody playing the music, but only the music being played, or there is nobody performing the 37 bodhipakya dhammas, but only the 37 bodhipakya dhammas being performed.
Yeah.
And that's the question. So would you agree with that?
Yeah. Would I agree with it? I can see the rationale behind that. If we think that all phenomena are impersonal in some kind of way, that all phenomena are non-self in some kind of way, then there is no self playing the music. It's just the music being performed in this kind of way. Obviously, one needs to develop the 37 bodhipakya dhammas to actually be able to do that. But yeah, so it's essentially, in a way, that's a bit of that comment, in a way, is congruent with the position that I talked about just throughout the talk, is that, you know, it's a kind of skillful action that one undertakes, and then there's a skillful perception of non-self that one undertakes when the 37 bodhipakya dhammas have come together into fruition. So yeah, that would probably come down on the position of the skillful self position, if I understood the question correctly. Somebody in the room have a question?
Oh yeah, I had a question. Oh well, actually,
yeah.
Oh no, it's not really clear. There's an article that has been going around Facebook, and it says Eastern philosophy says there is no self. Science agrees.
Yeah.
But it was just very funny. I was thinking about that, but it's based. Pretty much your talk kind of covered what the article was saying.
Yeah.
And that it says like neuroscience has got evidence to say that the left side of your brain is making up all the drama.
Yeah.
So it could be that, you know, you still need the other one to kind of override.
Yeah. Yeah. You've hit a sore spot of mine.
Yes.
people that equate things with science, and especially something like Buddhism, and equated that science now proves that Buddhism is true.
Yeah,
science works in a very different way. Science is you're continually moving forward. You're testing different ideas about the world, testing different hypotheses. The available evidence that you have at that time can sort of confirm your hypothesis. Maybe evidence that you have later might disconfirm your hypothesis in some kind of way. So if we're saying now that science now proves that Buddhism's right and there is no self, like, what happens if science keeps moving forward? Yeah. And they now prove that there is a self or something like that. So, well, it's Buddhism's wrong now. So I think there's different parts of scientific inquiry that are congruent with the non-self position.
But yeah, I don't like lumping them. Yeah, really, or, like lumping them all together.
It's like
together.
Picking and choosing things.
Yeah,
at the
yeah,
moment,
picking and choosing
the evidence.
Things. So yeah, you know, look, there's aspects there. Like when you're looking at the neuroscience of these kinds of things, is that, you know, basically when the like default mode network is activated, there's, you know, there's a feeling of a sense of self there. When that gets sort of, the default mode network is sort of an area in the brain that joins the frontal cortex and or all these different other parts in the brain. When that gets sort of deactivated, there isn't as much of a sense of self there when that happens. So yeah, you could say that you've got aspects like you know, the version of a narrative self that might come about through some of the left language hemispheres in the brain. There's basically a narrative trying to go on there in that kind of way. You could say that, and that is just sort of electrochemical activity. You could say that's a part of non-self, but it's the point is like, it's really hard to put these two things totally together. So yeah, I don't know if that answers the question, but it's just my pet gripe.
Yeah. It's just interesting to hear. I mean, it's obviously too long and it would be interesting to hear monks' responses.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
Buddhist responses to yeah. what's been going around now.
Yeah.
Which will get shared.
Yeah, I think there's some things that you could say, there's some findings that align with the doctrine of non-self. There's some findings that you could say, well, it actually doesn't align with the doctrine of non-self as well. Just again, like if you look in the Buddhist text for confirmation that the Buddha said that there's special kinds of selves, or he only said that there's not selves, you can pick and choose from a lot of this in there. Likewise with science, you can pick and choose a lot from there. Depends how you want to line these things up. So I think it's important just to be, whenever we look at these things, and just to be, you know, look at them at least with like a little bit of a skeptical eye and sort of go, well, what could be the outcomes of something like this? So yeah, share it with people if you want. Depends.
Thank you, Ajahn. The next online question is, how does non-self relate to rebirth?
God. I knew that was coming. It's again, there's so many tricky questions. There's many different ways that you can answer this. So you could say the traditional kind of Buddhist position is that obviously if things are non-self, there is no self soul that gets transmuted from birth to birth. But what the Buddha was actually saying, there's simply just causes and conditions that continue on from one life, and they can start to continue on to the next life. The Buddha said it was like the flame of a candle being passed from one candle to the other. You can't say that the two flames are the same things, but they're dependent on each other. So if we look at how from a traditional Buddhist perspective of how does the doctrine of non-self fit into the doctrine of rebirth, we have to look at something called paticca-samuppada, is the doctrine of dependent origination. How the Buddha says that, as Dr. Jaya was saying, that we start off with fundamental ignorance. From ignorance, then there's fabrication, sankharas are built up. Then there's this whole causal process that happens that brings about birth, that brings about old age, brings about sickness, and it brings about death. And if one still has avijja within this dependent origination, then one takes on rebirth again. Now, the idea here is that although there is dependent origination is dependent causal conditioning that's happening, that this actually doesn't need a self or a driver behind it. This simply is a causal process that happens. So we don't need a self for dependent origination to occur. Now, so this is a selfless process, but we are in some way, because we have avijja, we're enmeshed in it in some way. So we're experiencing the results of it all the time. We're experiencing birth, we're experiencing old age, sickness, and death because of avijja, because of the sankharas, because of the contact and all these kinds of things. So it fits into it in that way, that this is just a causal process. There's a, and I think a nice way to understand maybe the early Buddhist position on this is there's this really nice example from something called the Melinda Banha, or the Questions of King Melinda. It's from later commentary or kind of thing. This is where the King Melinda asked a monk called Nagasena this very question: well, if there's no self, what gets transmuted from birth to birth? And Nagasena answered him that, so you have to think about this in ways of like a, if you have a mango seed, if you have a mango seed and you plant the mango seed in the ground, if there's the right kinds of causes and conditions, the soil's good, the weather's good, it gets enough moisture, this mango seed will start to grow into a tree. As it starts to grow into a tree, it develops leaves, it starts to flower, starts to develop fruit. As the fruit grows, a mango comes from that. A mango might drop, and the mango has a seed in it, drops down into the ground again. And from this seed, from this mango, you know, another mango tree might arise. Now, you can't say that the second mango tree, you can't say that it's not reliant on the first mango tree, but you also can't say that it's the same thing as the original mango tree. The seed had the seed of the second mango tree had within it the requisite conditions from the first tree to actually come about into its current form. So, and you can look at the process of a mango seed growing into a tree, fruit dropping, another one going. There is no real self in that. This is just a process of nature. So that's one way to look at it. You could say that's a pretty coherent with the early Buddhist text accounts of it. That's one way you can look at it. Yeah. Mangala.
Thanks, Ajahn. That was a very insightful talk, I think, especially on a Sunday morning.
too much for 8 o'clock on a Sunday morning.
Keeps me awake at least. So thanks for that. I guess my question's a bit twofold. So number one, can you, I guess, elaborate a little bit on the difference between a sense of self and a sense of identity, right? Like, I think my understanding of that is a sense of self, as you explained, is kind of what's more inside your mind and head, whereas like identity is kind of something that you're projecting outwards. But if you can expand on that, and then that leads into the second question, which is what is I guess from our perspective, is it possible to have multiple senses of selves and or multiple senses of identities, and how does that work when it comes to interacting with other people's senses of selves and identities? So thanks.
Good question. So this is where if you remember at the start of the talk, I talked about maybe a line where people say that there is no self, and a line where people say maybe there's room for certain kinds of skillful selves that can be found in the early Buddhist texts. Now what it really depends on is how you're defining the sense of self here. If you're defining the sense of self in that way, if that there is this kind of little homunculus that's there inside my mind when I close my eyes, that there's this feeling of there's a feeling of a me, there's a feeling of a sense of self in there, this is something that feels like it's deep at my core, then this is something where we're maybe looking into more later Buddhist traditions, into the Dzogchen tradition and things like that, where we're looking more at this, the feeling of a sense of self in some kind of way. Again, this is just depending how you define the self. So if you are defining it in that way, we do seem like we have this feeling of, when I close my eyes, I feel like there's a me back there somewhere. Now, how is this, the question from that is then, well, how is this different to identity? Now, an identity is, you could say, imposing characteristics on that feeling of a sense of self. So you're identifying with that feeling of a sense of self in particular kinds of ways. Or if you're looking at the kind of traditional Buddhist interpretation, you're starting to identify with different aspects of the khandhas there. You could say you're identifying with aspects of the nama khandhas, so the feeling, perception, fabrications, and parts of consciousness there. You're identifying with it in some way. You're imbuing some kind of label or construct onto those things. Now, the question is, can you have different identities? Is there room for different identities here? Well, yeah, it just depends how you're interpreting the stimulus. If you're interpreting the stimulus in a different kind of way, you're attributing a different kind of identity onto those stimuluses, onto those occurrences there. So you could say, we have many different kinds of identity in this way. You might have the identity of, like, I want to be fit. I want to be healthy. I want to do all these kinds of things. But then like a chocolate cake comes in front of you and it's like, no, my identity is somebody that wants to relax and wants to reward themselves and, all these kinds of things. Again, depending how you're relating to the different stimuli that's in your environment. So different identities can come about in that way. You could have the identity, you could have the idea that, okay, this form that I have, it's like a 40-year-old man's form. It's in these kinds of clothes, there's different kinds of stimulus here, so I'm identifying as a 40-year-old Australian Buddhist monk. Again, reacting to stimulus in my environment in a particular way, bringing about a particular kind of identity. You can look at it in that way. That's just one way to actually look at it, where we can have multiple identities in this way. Now, the second question, and again, so you have the two, just to be clear, you have those two aspects there. You're defining self from that first person subjective perspective. This is what you're defining as a sense of self. You could define that in terms of the feeling of a sense of self, or you could define that as some kind of experience that's arising within consciousness dependent on the four namakandas. And, the way that we're responding to those four namakandas or that subjective sense of self is bringing about different kinds of identities in different ways. Now, the question is, if I remember the question correctly, is how can you use these identities to deal with other people's identities in this kind of way? So, was that the second question?
Yeah.
So, again, if we step back to aspects in the talk, what are we trying to do here? What's the fundamental axiom of Buddhist practice? Is that there is nibbana and that there is dukkha, and that we have, and this is dependent on our karma. We have akusala, we have skillful karma, we have unskillful karma. This is all we can really do. We can develop skillful karma or we can have unskillful karma. So the way that we relate to others, from that kind of principle is, are we relating to other people's identities in a skillful manner? Or are we doing it in an unskillful manner? Are we doing it from the perspective that this, whatever formulation of the aggregates that I have at the moment and however I'm identifying with it at the moment, is this operating in a skillful way that is leading me towards my long-term welfare and happiness, to others' long-term welfare and happiness? Or is it an unskillful action where I'm leading to not my long-term welfare and happiness and not others' long-term welfare and happiness, or maybe the harm of others? So this would be the idea. And from this, again, as I said, I don't really support this position, but it just is a position, this skillful self position, that you're using you're using the khandhas in this way to develop skillful qualities in your interactions with people, or you're using them in unskillful ways. So the idea here is, we can use these kinds of identities that we have, this kind of sense of self that we might have, to interact with the world in the most appropriate, skillful way, or we can do it in unskillful ways. So, that doesn't tell you how to do it, but that's just the basis of what it will be. Probably got time for one more question.
Thank you, Ajahn.
Yep.
I'm going to ask one which may just be a simple yes and no, and if it is, we'll go to another question, okay, if that's all right.
Okay. I don't usually give simple yeses.
No, but see how we go. Someone's just asking, so the skillful self, as you described it, seems to relate to the simile of the raft is something that you have for a while, then you let go. So someone there. So yes. Okay. Next question.
Yeah. So it was something I was going to bring up, but yeah, it's like the skillful, you know, you develop the raft, you build the raft with anybody that doesn't know. Again, I don't give short answers. Skillful qualities. You have to get across a river. You need to build a raft. You need to get twigs, leaves. There's probably better things these days to build a raft out of than twigs and rocks, but not rocks. But basically, you put something together that actually gets you across to the other side. When you get to the other side, you abandon the raft. So, yes, it would be. The skillful self would be that, the building of the raft, you could say. Yeah.
Thank you. Then we'll go to the last question,
yep.
which a few people have asked, is basically, how do you know when to use self and the non-self you?
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, that's the kind of the fundamental problem there is like problem's the wrong word, but that is, you know, the kind of fork, the dilemma that we're left with. Again, if we think, what is it that leads to my long-term welfare and happiness? What is it that leads to me progressing towards Nibbana? If a perception of a skillful sense of self leads one towards long-term welfare and happiness, to Nibbana, then you could say that's the right time to use a skillful sense of self. If a skillful perception of non-self leads to your long-term welfare and happiness and leads you towards Nibbana, that's the right time to use a skillful perception of non-self. If you looking at your actions and if it's an unskillful identification with the self, this is leading to not your long-term welfare and happiness, this is leading to dukkha, then you wouldn't do it. Or if it's an unskillful perception of non-self that is leading to your dukkha in some kind of way, you should have used it. An example here would be something like, I hate everything in existence. I hate everything in existence. It's all non-self. It's all just a waste of time. I hate it all, so I'm going to push it all away. That would be an unskillful use of the non-self reflection there. So if we look at it in that way, what's leading to my long-term welfare and happiness and leading towards Nibbana is either perspective of a skillful self perspective. Again, I'm not sort of saying that I ascribe to it in any way, but from that perspective, it's like, well, what kind of skillful feeling of a sense of self is leading me closer to that? Am I developing the qualities of dana? Am I developing skillful and unskillful? Sorry, skillful qualities, moral qualities that are leading me closer to that. Is that useful to get me towards Nibbana? And you know, when is the non-self perception? When is that leading me closer towards Nibbana? There's also, I guess, and I'll close it off with this because it's great. It's a great sort of reflection. It's like when we look at something like how we're interacting in the world, or if we're looking at how we're sort of practicing in some kind of way, there's very clear guidelines for us. As you know, say for example, in the moral realm in Buddhism, there's the five precepts, there's the eight precepts, or blah blah blah. Now, sometimes, but the world is messy. The world is, we're faced with different choices. Sometimes it's hard to make choices. And there's a sutta where the Buddha was talking to his son, Rahula. And he gave all these like really cool analogies that you give a kid to, examples that you give a kid to, but I think we can learn something from them. One of them, he said, Rahula, what is a mirror for? And Rahula says to him, it's for reflecting. And so the Buddha said, so with all of your acts of body, speech, and mind, you should be constantly reflecting on them. If you're about to do them, you should reflect, is this for my long-term welfare and happiness? Is this for others' long-term welfare and happiness? And if it is, then you should do this thing. If while you're doing an action, you should reflect on it. Is this for my long-term welfare and happiness? Is this not for my long-term welfare and happiness? Is it for others or is it for mine? If it is an action, then you should abandon it. If after you've done an action, you should reflect on it. Is this for my welfare and happiness, others' welfare and happiness? Then this is an action that is considered good and is considered useful. And if it's not, this is something that should be abandoned. So how do we use the skillful self and the skillful non-self in this particular kind of way, we just have to keep reflecting. We have to keep reflecting on the ways that we're actually operating in this way. Is it something that's leading to Nibbana, or is it something that's leading to Dukkha? Is it skillful? Is it unskillful? And that will probably do, because we could sort of talk about this all day. So with that, we'll call it a day. Invite everybody to come over and have some lunch. We'll do the arms round. And so we'll pay. Is there any final announcements? Nope. Okay, so we'll just pay respects to the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, and we can go over there.
Arahang Samma Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantang Abhivademi Soakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namassami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sanghang Namami.
Okay, very good. Hope to see you all over there for some lunch soon.